My name is Steve Casey. I'll be chairing this evening. Before I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, just two quick bits of business. The first bit of business is that this session is being recorded. And secondly, I'm asking you all if you can write any questions you have for the speaker into the chat. And then after Stephen has spoken, I'll then be moderating and passing your questions on to him. So that's how the Q&A is going to work. But it's my great pleasure, and this is the most important part of chairing the talk, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Stephen Wertheim, who is Deputy Director of Research and Policy at the Quincy Institute, and also a research scholar at the Saltzman Institute at Columbia, where he, I think, received his doctorate. He has published a number of very good scholarly articles in the Journal of Contemporary History and International Politics. Last week, I saw his op-ed piece in the New York Times, which is a little sneak peek of what he's talking about tonight, which is his new book, which is out in the UK next week. And it is called Tomorrow the World, The Birth of US Global Supremacy. It's published by Harvard. And I'll pass you over to Dr. Stephen Wertheim. Stephen.
Thank you so much, Steve, for that introduction. I'm delighted to be with everyone virtually, and I want to thank Grant for making the arrangements for this event with unmatched efficiency and grace, which is to say, not matched by me on the other end in terms of either efficiency or grace. My apologies for that. So let me pose a simple question. Why did the United States adopt military dominance as the fundamental objective of its role in the world? When did it first embrace global supremacy as a goal? And you might say it's more than that. It's an axiom. It's the premise from which most foreign policy debate in Washington, in the town behind me, proceeds. This was not always the case historically. Armed primacy wasn't a goal articulated by George Washington or John Quincy Adams. I think that much is uncontroversial. So at some point between then and now, American intellectuals and officials must have made a decision for dominance and turned it into an axiomatic truth in American politics. And when I ask audiences when they think the moment of rupture came, I won't do that here in our virtual environment, but you'll have to just take my word for it, that they give a remarkably wide range of dates. 1898, sometimes before then, World War I, the 1940s, the whole span of the 40s, maybe the 50s, even the 1990s. That is a big margin of error, to use our election season verbiage. So I want to propose that there was an identifiable moment of decision, and it came before the attack on Pearl Harbor put the United States into the Second World War, not earlier and not later. That is, before the United States officially entered World War II, it was already planning to lead the post-war world and in something like perpetuity. If that's so, perhaps it makes sense why the United States remains reflexively committed to military dominance in our own time, because military dominance comes out of what is basically universally perceived as its best moment as a nation, World War II, the crucible of the modern United States. Now, first, you may be wondering, how can I claim that scholars haven't squarely asked this question, how the United States made a decision for dominance? So I would submit to you that historians, political scientists, other scholars have developed two distinct ways of avoiding or deflecting the question. One group of scholars interprets the history as the victory of internationalism in an age-old struggle against isolationism. The idea is that throughout its history, the United States oscillated between these two basic forces before internationalism finally triumphed. This is also a really popular narrative among the public, educated public. The problem is this story is teleological. It's as if certain people, the internationalists, favored American supremacy all along. They needed only to sweep the isolationists or the non-internationalists out of the way. In fact, few self-described internationalists prior to World War II wanted the United States to be politically and militarily preeminent in the world. What made them internationalists was their desire to transcend power politics. For most of American history, that's what American leaders said they wanted. They hoped peaceful intercourse could supplant the reign of force, the circulation of goods, ideas, and people would give expression to the harmony they believed to be latent among nations, and this would prevent the resort to war. From this internationalist perspective, armed supremacy looked unnecessary at best and imperialistic at worst. What made the United States both exceptional and internationalist was that it did not covet supremacy. It promised to usher in a world of reason and rules, not force and whim. So then the category of isolationism makes even less sense to describe any group of Americans. Almost nobody throughout American history has presented themselves as an isolationist. The term is an epithet, and not only that, it wasn't used with any frequency before the 1930s. So it's just simply ahistorical to use the term as an analytic that could explain much of anything. The term, the ism, isolationism, came into usage only in the 1930s and early 1940s, invented for a particular reason that I'll get to. Okay, so that's the orthodox view. There's a second camp of scholars who reject the anti-isolationist narrative. These scholars dismiss isolationism as a myth and argue that America was always a superpower in the making. Didn't the United States, after all, expand constantly, whether it was driven by the material dynamics of capitalism or the ideology of exceptionalism? And that might be right, but if anything, this position gets us farther away from the question of how American foreign policy elites acquired the will to lead the world politically and militarily. It assumes that intentions, conceptions, didn't matter very much. This view ignores how reluctant American policymakers were to undertake what they construed as entanglements in Europe and Asia. The United States possessed the largest economy of any nation in the world by 1870. It then overtook the economy of the entire British Empire in the middle of World War I. But decade after decade, America's economic supremacy did not seem to imply to its ruling class a need for military supremacy. Only a rupture, a qualitative break, would change this state of affairs. That rupture did not arrive as late as 1939. It was then that President Franklin Roosevelt greeted Lord Lothian at the White House. Lothian was soon to be Britain's ambassador to the United States, and he told the American president that Anglo-Saxon civilization, in his words, needed a new guardian. The United States had to take the torch of world leadership from Great Britain. FDR was not having it. He, by his own account, mocked Lothian, got mad, and told him to toughen up. What the British need today is a good stiff grog, Roosevelt said. The president of the United States preferred to let the British lead the world politically and militarily, let them bear the brunt. Roosevelt didn't even suggest that, you know, perhaps the day might come when America would take over. He just showed no interest. And FDR was pretty typical of Americans before him. Almost no one before 1940 had imagined that the United States could or should emerge anytime soon as the world's preeminent power, permanently projecting its military across the globe. The world already had a leader in Great Britain, and American elites either accepted British leadership or doubted that the world needed any armed superpower whatsoever. Now, as I mentioned, of course, the United States dramatically expanded its territorial and military power since the founding of the country. In 1898, it became a great power. It acquired colonies in the Philippines and Puerto Rico, so it was undoubtedly an empire, and it gained dominance in the Western Hemisphere. And it entered World War I in 1917 and helped to create a post-war League of Nations. Yet American leaders continued to maintain the tradition that the United States should avoid entanglements, so-called, in Eurasia. And that's why even when President Woodrow Wilson promoted the League of Nations, he claimed it would be a disentangling alliance. It would prevent wars from starting. It would not be a vehicle for the United States to project armed force continually on a global scale. So it was still possible by 1939 for FDR to see Lothian out the door and dismiss U.S. primacy as a fantasy. And it wasn't just FDR in that moment. When World War II began in Europe, few Americans saw good reason to enter the war, much less take up arms after the war. Europe and Asia remained divided, and the Anglo-French alliance seemed much stronger than the fascist powers of Germany and Italy. In the State Department, a small group of post-war planners gathered at the beginning of 1940, and they all agreed that the United States would not be making military commitments beyond its own hemisphere. In fact, they spent most of their time planning to bring Mussolini's Italy to the side of the democracies in an attempt to mediate the settlement in Europe. And Sumner Welles was dispatched to Europe to explore this kind of possibility. The real action, however, came just outside the state in the Council on Foreign Relations, which was then 20 years old, but already an important think tank. Just 2 weeks before the war began in Europe, leaders of the council went to the State Department, and they said that they knew that short-staffed diplomats didn't have the resources to undertake long-term planning. "Let us do it for you," they suggested. "We'll send you our studies, we will follow your directives, and even better, we don't need any money. We've lined up the Rockefeller Foundation to fund us." Sumner Welles, the Undersecretary of State and FDR's man in the department, knew how to accept a good deal. The Council on Foreign Relations then gathered a group of about 100 planners, and here was the U.S. foreign policy elite at the time, writ small. It included the Army's top planner, General George B. Strong, the future CIA director, Alan Dulles, the Economic and Financial Group, one of four groups in the Council planning, was led by both America's leading Keynesian economist, Alvin Hansen of Harvard, and his neoclassical rival from Chicago, Jacob Viner. After Pearl Harbor, the council planners, many of them were transplanted into the State Department, where they formed the backbone of the State Department's official post-war planning committee. But until then, they were the main post-war planners in the United States. So I'm getting a little bit ahead, though, because I want to take seriously the period of the so-called phony war in Europe from September 1939 to May of 1940. In this period, the planners didn't know what they wanted. They certainly didn't want Nazi Germany to win, but they also feared a rapid British and French victory. That might result in an exclusive trading bloc, an Anglo-French trading bloc that could exclude the United States. As I mentioned, the Council on Foreign Relations had a special military group led by Alan Dulles and the New York Times military analyst Hanson Baldwin. And I want to tell you what the group was doing in the spring of 1940 as the Nazis marched into Denmark and Norway. The group was painstakingly cataloging schemes for disarmament. They went all the way back to the ancient Greeks, who had prohibited poisoning wells, and they went right up to Winston Churchill's suggestion in 1913 that there be a one-year holiday on naval building. So the memo they sent to the State Department on May 1st, 1940, on the verge of the Nazi invasion of France, described all these disarmament schemes. In short, post-war planners, up to that point, found themselves following old internationalist formula by default. Promote intercourse, seek disarmament, but avoid political military entanglement in Eurasia. Then the Nazis invaded France. To the surprise of everyone, including many German generals, France fell, and it fell within 6 weeks. Suddenly, Hitler was master of Europe, and for a time it seemed likely that the Nazis would conquer Britain and perhaps the British Empire as well. Now the American political class perceived a crisis. Congress quickly instituted the first ever draft in peacetime, and it approved a vast military buildup. The first citizens' groups also sprung up, now advocating outright intervention in the war. Now, it's not easy to explain, though, what the crisis was all about. As John Thompson has pointed out, few observers believed North America faced much danger of being successfully invaded from across the Atlantic, even if Hitler were to win. And the U.S. economy was so self-contained, especially after the Depression, that it did not need much foreign trade. America, that is, remained safe and prosperous. And the post-war planners in the Council on Foreign Relations came to this conclusion. At the depth of the crisis in the summer of 1940, they assumed that henceforth the United States would be confined to its own hemisphere, and in fact, only a quarter sphere, in this remarkable phrase that appears for a brief period of time and then goes away. This quarter sphere extended, in their view, from North America down to the bulge of Brazil, where it juts out into the Atlantic, and that would be it. This would be the area that the United States would trade in and militarily defend for the foreseeable future. And in crude material terms, the planners thought there wasn't much wrong with that. The economists Hansen and Viner concluded that the U.S. economy could perform adequately within this quarter sphere. For that reason, some Americans believed the United States should build its military strength so it would guard the Western Hemisphere except against any outside invasion. It just should not commit to go any further. This is essentially the view of a motley coalition of Americans who gathered under the banner of America First starting in the fall of 1940. The appeal of this position was significant. Secure between the oceans, the United States could remain at peace and cultivate within the Americas the basis of a safe and free world. Thus, the United States could continue its internationalist and nationalist tradition of engaging with everyone but avoiding power politics in the old world. But by the autumn of 1940, as Britain withstood German bombing, FDR and other foreign policy elites began to make a different choice. To them, a hemispheric existence, however adequate, was not ideal. As internationalists, American elites expected to be able to trade and move across the globe on basically liberal terms. And as exceptionalists, they expected the United States would define world history. This was the problem if Axis powers were to rule Europe and Asia, or if another totalitarian power were ever to do the same in the future. America's territory might be safe, its economy might be sound, but it would be isolated from the world, isolated from history, to use this recurring term. FDR himself warned that if Hitler defeated Britain, America would become, quote, a lone island in a world dominated by the philosophy of force. In this scenario, Americans would become a people, quote, lodged in prison, handcuffed, hungry, and fed through the bars from day to day by the contemptuous, unpitying masters of other continents. Now, FDR was assuming the United States would still be the supreme power in the Western Hemisphere and safe in North America. And yet he still said the United States would become a passive sufferer, receiving world history rather than generating it. The idea of isolation switched the goalposts. It implied that it was bad enough for the United States to be confined to the Western Hemisphere, even if it was secure and prosperous. Previously, internationalism had hinged on the assumption that intercourse would transcend force, at least sometime in the future. But Hitler's conquest had seemed now to prove the opposite true. Intercourse depended on force. There could be no trade, no law, no order, except if defended or imposed by hegemonic force. Let me take a few minutes to describe how the Council's planners put this insight into practice. I mentioned the quarter sphere area devised in June and July in 1940, right after France fell. And then in the 3 months that followed, the economists undertook a monumental study at the request of the State Department. To ask the question, how much of the world did the United States really want for the future after the war? They assumed, at this point, that Nazi Germany would control the whole of Europe for the foreseeable future. What they sought to find was a post-war area that met several criteria. It would be an area that would be economically self-sufficient. It would be more self-sufficient than the projected Nazi-led Europe. That way, the Nazis would have less bargaining power. Also, there would be no governmental regimentation of trade, so the only way to get rid of trade imbalances would be to make the area bigger to export surplus goods. And finally, the United States would have to take the lead in defending the whole area by force. So these are, at the outset, an expansive set of requirements. They propose no real compromise with liberal capitalism, and they call for a superior position geopolitically and geoeconomically over a Nazi-led Europe for the foreseeable future. The planners started out considering a post-war sphere consisting of the whole Western Hemisphere. Alas, they found the hemisphere to be insufficient. It left South America with large trade surpluses, and that was in August of 1940. So in September, the planners added a massive Pacific region, including Australia, India, and even Japan at this point. The planners just assumed that Japan could be integrated into the U.S.-led area. This in the same month that Japan joined the Tripartite Pact with Germany and Italy. In any case, this area too was deemed to be insufficient. It still left large surpluses of agricultural goods. So then in October 1940, the planners added in the rest of the British Empire, including the British Isles. Thus, they wound up with the whole non-German world, with a notable exception of the Soviet Union, which they just ignored throughout these studies because it was neutral in the war and didn't have much foreign trade. On this basis, the planners concluded that the United States must hold, and I quote, unquestioned power in the world, and use, quote, its military power to protect the maximum possible area of the non-German world. This plan came to be called the Grand Area, and if there's a single first blueprint for U.S. military supremacy, it's this. I don't want to overstate its importance. I think it was only a somewhat more rigorous display of the kind of thinking that was happening more broadly. But it does vividly illustrate how rapidly America's imagined place in the post-war world changed in the span of just 5 months, leaping from the quarter sphere area to the grand area. In the next month, in November, the U.S. Navy developed the first war plan that linked U.S. security to the global balance of power and the survival of the British Empire. So by the end of the year, American foreign policy elites were just starting to glimpse a future of U.S. military supremacy, precisely because they had lost faith in internationalism as previously understood, because peaceful interaction could no longer be trusted to overcome power politics. The United States had to keep order by force. Now let me turn to 1941. When a new concept of internationalism arose to replace the old one. My book extends to 1945, but I'll stop today basically before Pearl Harbor because I want to convey how much of America's place in the world had been conceived even before then. At the time, in fact, many interventionists like the columnist Walter Lippmann repeated that the United States was in the war in all but name. The year began with FDR's Four Freedoms speech, the passage of Lend-Lease aid to the Allies, and after that it was clear the United States would sooner stop the Axis than keep out of war, even if it still preferred to keep out of war. Suddenly, in 1941, a new world order became a matter of wide discussion. With America rearming, now the United States seemed destined to define the future. Publishing mogul Henry Luce proclaimed a start to the American century already in February 1941. And during the whole year, magazines and newspapers were filled with proclamations about the distant future. In 1941, it seemed urgent to articulate an alternative to the Axis New Order, to its claims to world leadership in Europe and Asia. In private, post-war planners considered how to implement the American century. And in 1941, they gave a clear answer. Planners at this point envisioned an exclusive American-British alliance to police the post-war world. This was a model that they defined against a general world organization. As one planner explained, the chief lesson of the interwar years is that, quote, peace cannot be assured without force. Force that is overwhelming and controlled by, quote, those whose self-interest will ensure its utilization. Hanson Baldwin, the New York Times military analyst, led his armaments group in sketching out the bases from around the globe from which an American-British police force would operate. World order, he now said frankly, would require, quote, world domination by the United States and the British Empire. The planners admitted that what they were conceiving was a policy, quote, essentially offensive in character. This was the same military group, I hasten to add, that was cataloging disarmament proposals before the fall of France. At the peak of Anglophone feeling in early June of 1941, the CFR planners went so far as to draft an act of Congress to grant American citizenship to citizens of the British Commonwealth, that is, the white settler dominions. This is not an idea that got very far, but it does reveal how the planners drew inspiration not from the League of Nations or other universalist schemes, but rather from the British Empire. And FDR was thinking along somewhat similar lines. In August of 1941, he and Winston Churchill released the Atlantic Charter, the first official statement of post-war aims. This is a document that historians sometimes present as a step toward the eventual universal United Nations. But at the time, FDR refused to endorse any post-war organization over the objections of Churchill, actually. He explained that only America and Britain could keep peace in the post-war world. But the Atlantic Charter fell like a dead duck in the estimation of the council planners as they looked at the reaction in Congress and in the public. They quickly worried that the biggest obstacle lay at home. U.S. global supremacy sounded imperialistic. It sounded contrary to traditional ideals of internationalism. As the planners commentated, Woodrow Wilson's 14 points had envisaged universal disarmament, at least eventually. But FDR, in his 8 points, as the Atlantic Charter was initially called, promised indefinite domination by America and Britain. Even John Foster Dulles, the future Cold Warrior Secretary of State, objected at the time to the Atlantic Charter's vision of, quote, Anglo-Saxon military and economic hegemony. Would the public refuse to shoulder the burdens of leadership? Now the planners penned a rebuke to the Atlantic Charter, less for its content than for its optics. A week before Pearl Harbor, the group warned the State Department, and I quote them, that an imperialistic connotation may all too easily be given to the projected American-British policing of the seas, not only by Axis propaganda mongers, but by perfectly sincere people as well. In short, U.S. supremacy needed to be legitimated. And beginning at the end of 1941 and continuing throughout the war, elites hit upon a solution: reclaim the mantle of internationalism and international organization. Now they positioned U.S. military supremacy as the epitome of internationalism as opposed to this new construction, isolationism. This way, armed dominance became the culmination of at least a partial American tradition. And historians wrote back new narratives that projected the internationalism-isolationism dichotomy to the very founding of the country, certainly to the World War I debate, as if advocates of internationalism, meaning supremacy, had been there all along. In addition, post-war planners now embraced world organization because some kind of organization seemed essential for convincing the U.S. public to accept world leadership. Because international organizations symbolize the old aspiration to end power politics, it could become a useful vehicle to implement, even dominate, power politics. Thus, just after achieving victory over Japan in October 1945, a new president, Harry Truman, could stand before Congress and proclaim as a matter of course, we must relentlessly preserve our superiority on land and sea and in the air. Okay, let me just conclude with some implications for the present, and I'll try to be as quick as I can. I think the wartime origins of armed primacy tell us something paradoxical and fundamental about U.S. foreign policy today. On the one hand, America's commitment to global dominance easily outlasted the Cold War competition with Soviet communism. Global dominance had never been about a particular adversary. It was conceived as a long-term project. It was grounded in the argument that a decent world order required armed enforcement, including to nip future possible aggressors in the bud. So in the 1990s, Soviet communism collapsed, and American leaders responded not really by pulling back, but rather by fulfilling their aspiration for one world united under American armed supervision. Here's the paradoxical part. Something crucial has changed in the world since the 1940s. It isn't the lack of a great power rival per se, but rather the disappearance of totalitarianism as an alternative expansive system, as a way of organizing national and international society and exchanges across borders. The original case for primacy depended upon the specter of a totalitarian other that could corrupt liberal intercourse. Free intercourse, it turned out, wasn't free, it had to be imposed. But today, the specter arguably doesn't exist. Communism died, it stayed dead, or, as in China, it rose again, only by mutating into one-party state capitalism, which is open for business with the rest of the world, and in fact, China is the world's largest trading nation. Could say a lot more about that. But in this kind of a world, with authoritarianism, yes, but global exchange too, with freer exchange in finance and goods than at any time since before the First World War, exactly why does the United States need to maintain military preeminence? Might the pursuit of primacy be more likely to create antagonisms that disrupt exchange and interaction and peace? At the very least, armed primacy comes with upfront costs in lives and treasure. These questions now seem out in the open today. This is partly because Donald Trump ran for president and won, promising a different foreign policy, one that U.S. experts misunderstood as isolationist, but that did pass muster with voters or enough voters in the right places. Trump does not oppose U.S. military primacy, I want to be clear. To the contrary, he's promised from the beginning to build up the supposedly depleted U.S. military. He said, quote, our military dominance must be unquestioned. Trump pursues peace through strength, the same theory as his predecessors. But Trump does make clear that U.S. world leadership faces a crisis of legitimacy today in the United States. Not many people believe he or his administration have a strategy to use power or a theory to bring peace. Armed domination has become an end unto itself, which means I think the country faces a choice. Americans could openly espouse endless war, which the planners of military dominance, many of them understood, would be the price of admission. Or they could chart a new course for the rest of the 21st century. Now, I have my personal preference, but as a historian, I do at least want to insist upon one thing. I want to insist that we should reject the advice of Henry Luce, who wrote in his American Century essay that Americans had to decide between, quote, those old, old labels, internationalism and isolationism. He wrote, we can make a truly American internationalism something as natural to us in our own time as the airplane or the radio. And that's exactly what happens. He won. Americans since then came to find their supremacy to be natural. They accepted that internationalism and isolationism were indeed the horizons of possibility in their foreign policy. I hope new generations will free themselves up to be more creative. So I will just leave it there, and I very much look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you very much. Just to reiterate for those who joined a bit later, all the questions will be coming via the chat, and I will relay them. I've got three questions from Sanjeev Kumar. So what I'll try and do is I'll paraphrase them, if that's okay, Sanjeev. I think Sanjeev's got two big points. The first point is how far back. I think he's challenging your notion that this is 1940. And he's arguing that actually, what about the Monroe Doctrine? What about American fears of wars in Europe dating even back to the 18th century? And wasn't there always an underlying fear in the United States about getting sucked into European wars, which presumably underpins a more militaristic approach? He also then asks the second question, which is, who were the most cohesive and persistent voices against the viewpoint that you very articulately presented there? Who were the ones challenging these elites at the time?
Terrific. Okay. Weighty questions. So I understand the first question to be about, you know, why not see the U.S. will to world dominance coming sooner than my very specific attempt to locate it in a moment of decision in 1940 and 41. And I am with the many historians who see the United States quite ambitious in its desire to expand what Thomas Jefferson called the empire of or for liberty. I think there's no question about that. The record of territorial expansion first across North America, which was a massive kind of internal colonization project, and then to take colonies, major colonies, okay, the Philippines, millions of people ruled by the United States for 44 years, as Daniel Immerwahr has written about in a great book. You know, this is not an insignificant part of America's record in the world. The thing I just want to insist upon, let's take the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine, yes, it ambitiously, over-ambitiously at the time, because the U.S. Navy was too weak to enforce it, said that the United States wanted to see an entire Western Hemisphere, a new world that would eventually be rid of European colonization. But by the same stroke, it reciprocally forbade U.S. intervention in the system of power politics in Europe. So that right there, I think, encapsulates a basic U.S. approach to its world role through much of the 19th century or even extended 19th century. The United States will act very aggressively in the New World realm, but kind of on the condition that this not extend beyond because of the imagined separation between the new and old world. So there was a kind of limit, at least theoretically, put on U.S. expansion, which means that something has to change in order for the hemispheric limitation to become global. And it's that specific point where I think my story comes in. And we have to explain in our own time why it is that U.S. politicians don't even really pay lip service to Washington's golden rule or to you know, a very traditional, well-established American tradition of avoiding what were called entanglements in the old world. So that's what I'm interested in myself. Who are the most cohesive viewpoints against the emerging interventionist, internationalist position? Well, there was quite a strong movement, and you know, America First was the kind of banner for most of the people who were against intervention in the war. Implicitly, now I want to just say, you know, there were it was a motley group of a hugely varying ideological and political disposition. That's why an anti-New Dealer like Henry Luce is in favor of American supremacy along with FDR on the one hand, and on the other side, the coalition was incredibly broad. We've got, you know, Democratic Socialist Norman Thomas in that coalition, as well as the anti-Semitic aviator Charles Lindbergh. And each side had a different way of putting their blend of nationalism and internationalism, and provided a pretty cohesive basis for their worldview that had deep roots in American history. And so, you know, it's I don't want to overstate the notion that there was a contingency in the moment. I think FDR's viewpoint was, well, he wasn't eager to, he was very prudential, not eager to get involved in the war if he didn't have to. He was clearly against the emerging America First position, or one that would impose hemispheric restrictions on the U.S. use of force. But, you know, there was a powerful, politically potent coalition of people who were available. And had, you know, politics at the elite level turned out a bit differently, we might have had a different outcome. But one interesting thing, and I think this deserves further research, because my book is really about the people who win. It's about the interventionist internationalists who conceive of American global supremacy. I don't say much about their critics. And so, you know, I think it's interesting to ask, you know, how much criticism was given to the idea of long-range U.S. global dominance at the time, even amidst the more proximate question that absorbed many people of how and whether the United States should get involved in World War II. And, you know, I do capture in the book some moments where people like Robert Taft, the Republican senator, opposed to intervention in the war, or Charles Beard, one of his intellectual allies, articulate that they see a future for the United States very similar to that of the British Empire, a future where the United States will get embroiled in, you know, what they say is everyone's troubles, and engage in something like endless war. So they seem to perceive that the stakes of this question aren't just the immediate stakes of the war, but a longer term one as well. But I do think more work needs to be done to try and separate out the longer term question on their side from the short term question.
Thanks very much, Dick. The next question actually is from Matthew Jones, and it's pretty much the question I was going to ask. So I'm going to ask Matthew's question and put my own little twist on it, if that's okay. And I suppose sort of to paraphrase Matthew, it is, okay, yes, a lot changes in June 1940, but perhaps it's not June 1940 that's a pivotal moment when America decides on armed supremacy, and that's the phrase you give. It's actually 10 years later. It's June 1950, and you go back to Robert Jervis's famous article, The Impact of the Korean War on the Cold War. And the problem that you get if you are one of these elites that you're talking about is that after World War II, Truman in particular, but along with the Republican Party, is pushing a demobilization agenda. And when Truman wins election in his own right in 1949, he very firmly pushes, forcibly pushes, a demobilization agenda. And that's, I think you mentioned another character there, Robert Taft. When there is that change in the wake of the Korean War, the implementation of NSC 68, one of the key arguments that Taft has against this is that militarization is, and this goes right the way back to the founding period, it undermines the constitutional nature of the American Republic. It's going to lead to a garrison state. And there's that, I think, very powerful other counter thought there. So how would you respond to the fact that actually, as a political project, when World War II's over, the armed side of the primacy actually does start to struggle for 5 years until the Korean War comes along and sort of saves your characters and their viewpoint?
I think that's an incredibly fair and powerful point. I think if we're talking about a decision for dominance, including, massive U.S. military budgets and forward deployments, then I agree with you, the sort of end of that process, where pretty much everything is set in place, is indeed NSC 68 and its implementation during the Korean War. So I think that's, very fair. And so, you might say that not all of the elements of American armed primacy are totally in place by 1945, and there's no doubt that both the American public and a number of leaders are seeking at that point to have large-scale demobilization, and also seeking, not to have a kind of Cold War conflict with the Soviet Union either. So that's all true. There's a reason, though, that I stop at 1945 in the book, because I really do want people to appreciate how much was in place at that point of American dominance. Yes, the United States sought to cooperate in a four policemen mode with the Soviet Union as well as with the other great powers, but it was very much on the condition that the United States would be the preeminent power in this arrangement. And I really think that the argument had been accepted, certainly at the elite level, perhaps also at the popular level, that the United States in principle had the responsibility in the world and the interests, that if the balance of power was ever threatened by a hostile rival, especially a totalitarian rival, it would have to be the lead actor in making sure that it preserved, in Mel Leffler's words, a preponderance of power. And so in Leffler's book, we enter the Truman administration with, at least in his telling, top to bottom, U.S. foreign policy officials have this bedrock belief. And then the question is exactly how to how to implement that given the interest in demobilization, given the how they're trying to work out in real time the nature of Soviet aims and behavior and so forth. So there's another reason why I like to stop at 1945, and it's a little bit more to do with making a useful past. I mean, a lot of people try to go back who say, the Korean War is what went wrong. NSC 68 was unbounded. Or maybe Kennan's original containment version, was hard to contain itself. I think if you look at the consensus as of 1945, that was very hard to contain. It's hard to find real limitations, strong limitations on the projection of U.S. military power at that point. And I think there's all this nostalgia to go back to World War II, to the original good moment, best moment of American dominance. And I want people to really take a look at that and ask themselves, how much there do we want to return to, and how much there, particularly given the instrumental way in which the United Nations was conceived, and we didn't talk much about that, that's fine, but how much there is really a basis for American foreign policy moving forward?
Thanks very much. The questions are coming in thick and fast. I'm taking them in order, so apologies if I don't get to them. There's two that I'll ask here, two quite different ones, but one builds on that, which is a counterfactual, builds on this whole Truman administration. What would have happened had Henry Wallace not been kicked off the ticket in 1944 and Henry Wallace had become president in April 1945? Would that have led to a different outcome? That's one question. I think you probably dealt with that. But a much bigger question is, do you think, and this is from Cain Carlisle, that the role of terrorism, the threat of terrorism, has replaced the spectre of communism as the motivating justifier for the continued dominance of this seeking primacy?
Great. So Henry Wallace, had he become president, and we could ask whether the if in the counterfactual was not itself, I guess it was relatively possible. All right, I'll just roll with it. How's that? So if Henry Wallace becomes president and remains president, okay, ifs, but nevertheless, it's quite possible that the Cold War as such might have been avoided. We know that he, in real time, objected to it in the Truman administration on the grounds that he believed that, in kind of good Rooseveltian fashion, that basic cooperation, at least diplomacy with the Soviet Union, was still a possibility. That said, though, my narrative finds some things about Henry Wallace that surprised me. He was very much on board with U.S. global dominance in 1941. In fact, he was part of the people in the chaotic Roosevelt administration, who could see where things were going and who engaged in a bureaucratic scramble to try and become the point person to head up post-war planning for the administration. He ultimately had a piece of the pie in that as head of the Board of Economic Warfare, but not to the extent he wanted. The State Department won that battle. But he met with a number of the Council on Foreign Relations planners in 1941 and was absolutely in favor of U.S. dominance in tandem exclusively with the British Empire at that point, to police the world. So that's a very interesting fact. So that suggests that record to me, and of course he did this as more of an Anglophobe than an Anglophile. For him, because the United States would be the preeminent power in the relationship, it was actually a way of limiting some of the negative effects he saw in British world power. So that idea had appeal for both admirers and detractors of the British Empire and the United States. So that history suggests to me that, yes, the Cold War itself might have been different, but the desire for the United States to become the dominant military power with responsibility in principle for enforcing world order was something that even Henry Wallace, if he had become president, if he had remained president long enough to have real impact subscribe to. With respect to the role of terrorism, I think certainly a number of policymakers and intellectuals in the United States saw after 9/11 terrorism as something that would re-legitimate, that would give new purpose to America's leadership role in the world. The notion of Islamo-fascism was put forward by a number of neoconservative and liberal internationalist intellectuals, as well as, I think, the George W. Bush himself. I may be mistaken about that. And that sort of suggests exactly that, you know, this attempt to position terrorism in a lineage of the Axis powers, Soviet communism. But I don't think it succeeded, interestingly enough, even though the 9/11 attacks were an attack on the American people, on the American homeland, killing 3,000 people and causing a lot of other destruction and health problems for people. In fact, I think in the last 4 years, even though President Trump ran hyping the threat of what he insisted on calling radical Islamic terrorism, even in his administration, actually the specter of terrorism has declined considerably, and his administration has shifted to what the Pentagon calls great power competition as its orienting principle. Great power competition is partly in opposition to terrorism or the war on terrorism for the administration. And now I think even the administration has gone beyond that and is centered on China as the kind of main threat for the United States to deal with in the world. And I think China is more potent than terrorism. At the end of the day, terrorist groups are weak. They have not succeeded in conquering much territory. It's a strange replacement for a force that could potentially take over most of Europe and Asia, subvert the balance of power, and force the United States to live in a fundamentally hostile world order. Terrorism never really, I think, was capable, was just powerful enough of fitting that bill. China is a more serious proposition, though. And so one thing I'm looking for as the debate about what to do about China continues in Washington is the extent to which China is cast in kind of neo-Cold War, neo-Soviet terms as an implacably expansionist power and as a totalitarian or crypto-totalitarian power whose every act, whose every spread of its influence is a kind of loss for the free world and by extension the United States. I think that's clearly what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has suggested in some of his recent speeches, but I'm not sure that that view is firmly entrenched now in both political parties.
Thanks. We are running out of time. I think we've got time for two more questions, if that's okay. Again, I'll lump them together. The first one is from Alexandros, who actually had also asked about Henry Wallace, but you've already answered that. His other question was about how America conceives empire. And there's been a lot of talk about the United States pushing an informal empire rather than the formal empire. And how does that play out in what you talked about, this Anglo-American dialogue about empire that's emerging in 1940 and particularly 1941? So that's the first question about how does America conceive of empire in this period of time. The last question I'm going to give to Grant, because he's done all the heavy lifting in terms of the organizing. I'll paraphrase his question. He brings up the book and the argument by Fred Loggerval and Campbell Craig, and I think they're using a term first coined by C. Van Woodward, this whole idea of free security, which had been the sort of dominant, according to Woodward, the dominant theme of American existence up until the period of the 1940s and the 50s. And of course, one of the things that Roosevelt himself is concerned by is the way in which technology is eliminating this free security. And Grant wants to know, what role does technological change have in the debates that you are dealing with in 1940 and 1941?
Okay, much to say and 3 minutes to say it in. On the issue of empire, I found this quite interesting in the archives. First of all, America had an empire, a formal colonial empire, right, coming into World War II. Puerto Rico, Philippines, Hawaii, Alaska. So that's why I don't take empire. I'm happy if you want to describe U.S. power as imperial, I think that's fine. I don't think it does very much one way or the other. And that's not the change specifically that I seek to describe because the United States comes into the period as an empire. But, one of the connotations of empire for the actors that I was looking at was indeed a kind of large scale, more powerful than others, world ordering entity. And so many of them appealed to Great Britain in the period, even if they wanted to avoid saying the United States would become an empire or become exactly like Britain in the century to come. They would say that the US, they would very freely admit, the US needed to take over the role that Great Britain had played. And traditionally, the United States had objected to that role. So, in real time, there was a kind of revaluation of how Britain had led the world from the 19th century up to that point. So, I would say that the best way I can describe the kind of U.S. interest or the U.S. conception of itself as potentially becoming an empire would be empire adjacent. It was somehow inescapable for these actors to think of the United States as a kind of empire. Even if they re were reluctant, certainly in public, to cast the United States in that role. And it's precisely out of this reluctance that the United Nations organization becomes valuable for American post-war planners because they know that, if the public sees the United States as an empire, that is not something that's going to create a legitimate basis for U.S. power projection going forward. Just with respect, briefly to the free security point, I'm pretty much with John Thompson in his book, The Sense of Power, on this one. I think there's a lot of appeals in, FDR talks about this, so do other interventionists, about how the world has changed, technology has changed things, and therefore the United States can't use its oceans for security like it could in the past, and the world's interconnected. I mean, one reason is that this is also an argument made by Woodrow Wilson and other advocates of U.S. Intervention in World War I. And I have a hard time crediting technological change as being truly explanatory in this case. Not that I think anyone was acting in bad faith when they were making these arguments, but was it actuating their shift of views? In part because the main technological change that they cited, the advent of air power, was also used by anti-interventionists to argue that actually free security was more reliable than ever because the advent of air power helped to fortify the defense of coastlines more than it helped possible invading powers mount a successful conquest across the oceans. And so when Britain hangs on in its battle against the Luftwaffe. That becomes a powerful argument for non-interventionists to say, look, if the Channel could thwart the Nazi war machine, just imagine what the Atlantic Ocean can do.
Well, that's fantastic, Stephen. You almost exactly on time. I'm going to have to apologise to all those who didn't get their questions answered, but I think the reason is simply that the subject we were dealing with today is so interesting. I think the speaker, Stephen Wertheim, was so exciting and stimulating, and it's a fantastic new book. I do encourage you all to go out and buy it next week when it's out. And I just want to finish by offering our warmest thanks for Stephen, and hopefully we'll see him in person at some stage in the near future. And I see a few hand claps. I'm not quite sure how to do that, but I would like to also just very large.